Hello and welcome to F1 Explains 2024. It is the first of our season and I cannot wait to get back with the community, take a big old dive with Christian Hugel. I'm Katie Osborne and we are stoked to have you guys here for our first F1 Explains of the 2024 season.
Katie.
Christian.
We're back.
Wait. We're here. We're here together and we're here with the F1 Explains community. And I think that is what we learned in 2023 was how many people are listening that actually want to be part of this show, not just listen to the show. They want to be part of it. They want to engage with us. And I am so excited to be on board with you, Christian, producer Chris, and the rest of our F1 Explains crew.
We're back with F1 Explains for 2024. We are bigger and better than ever before. We have all sorts of exciting plans this season to take you right to the very heart of Formula One. This is the official Formula One podcast, which every week answers your questions. We put them to experts up and down the world of Formula One with Katie Osborne, me, Christian Hugill, and if you're new, you're very welcome. This is just a tiny bit of what we got up to last season.
Double world champion Mika Häkkinen, welcome to F1 Explained.
That they could make up what are you doing, man? what are you doing?
And by your side, a woman whose race strategy once made Sergio Perez cry.
I'm speechless, guys.
It's important for me to say tears of joy. Welcome back, Bernie Collins.
Thank you so much. You've just not heard the crying ones from losing the race.
Are you F1 Explains?
We are.
I love your podcast.
Love F1 Explains. Christian Hugill.
Oh my God.
And Katie Osborne.
Katie Osborne.
Your neck has got to be stronger than you would think. And it makes it very annoying when you go try and buy a suit because people look at you and they're like, oh, you're a size 15 neck. And it's like, no, sir, I'm an 18. They're like, no. It's like, yeah, measure it. I dare you. All the F1 drivers, big necks, man. Big necks.
You were one of the very key people behind sort of transforming Formula One pit stops into the modern age. So, I know you'll be modest about it, but is that a fair comment?
Yeah, I think it is really. I'm not really one for, I don't take praise very well, but yeah, that I'd say it probably is.
Ladies and gentlemen, joining me, Christian Hugill and Katie Osborne on the stage is Formula One legend, David Coulthard! Now we are back and the final few weeks before a new F1 season are such an exciting time. It's always a big moment around this time, every February, when the teams reveal their cars for the new year. And if you're like me, spending ages looking at pictures online of every last little detail and then at the real cars themselves once they hit the track, it's amazingly exciting. But the question I'd like to ask Katie Osborne is, how long have these beautiful new creations been cooking for?
Ah, that's a very good question. And in fact, Christian, lucky enough, this week on F1 Explains, it's new Formula One cars. And over the next 30 minutes or so, we're going to be hearing how these teams start designing a new car and how long it actually takes for them to get from idea, pen and paper, to reality.
Yes, welcome to F1 Explains, new Formula One cars. We will introduce you to our special guest in just a minute, because as always, we have questions from our listeners all over the world to put to him, and you can send us yours on any topic. And I've got some big breaking F1 Explains news, Katie. It's incredibly exciting. We have a new email address. Get your pens and paper out. Get ready. It's incredibly complicated. F1explains@f1.com.
That's it.
I mean, it's not that
That's
complicated,
it. What we
is
got.
It?
We'll be what fine. Is it again, Christian?
F1explains@f1.com. Ask us anything you like about Formula One, and we will find experts to put said questions to.
And speaking of those questions, we have an email from Fan from California. And if that's Fan from California and your name is Fan, like Fannie Mae, that's awesome. And if it's you're just a fan from California, please let us know what your first name is. Please feel free to email us back and let us know.
We're not sure, are we? We think no, could be Fan or they're a Fan. There's not much of a
I'm
clue.
I'm guessing it's Fan, a singular Fan. Her name is not Fannie.
Okay.
Anyways,
well,
and David from Guam, they both asked, when does development on the car for the new season start?
Well, Fan and David, we have just the expert to answer that and a whole lot more besides. Dan Fallows is a hugely respected name in Formula One. He started in the sport all the way back in 2002 with the Jaguar team. Now, they became Red Bull Racing, winning 8 world titles in 4 years between 2010 and 2013. Dan was involved. He eventually became the head of aerodynamics, working alongside the legendary figure in the sport that is Mr. Adrian Newey.
And then Dan joined Aston Martin as their technical director, and the first car he designed for them stunned the competition.
Please welcome back to the Formula One podium for the 99th time, Fernando Alonso, who weaves across the line and celebrates a dream debut with Aston Martin.
Yes, 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 mate. Well done, that's P3.
Yes, what do you have done, guys? What do you have done?
That was one of 8 podiums Aston scored in 2023, the team's best F1 season. Now, Dan can't take all the credit for that. It's, of course, a huge team effort. But as the guy in overall charge of creating the car, it was pretty central to their success.
Katie, it's rare we disagree, but I'm going to disagree with you now. He's the only one on our podcast, so I am giving him all the credit. I think it was all down to Dan.
I'm sure he's a humble man. I don't know that he would feel that way.
nor would Fernando Alonso. But you know,
but hey,
he's not right here.
How about Lance?
Dan is. Sorry, Fernando. Sorry, Lance. I'm giving it to Dan
and
at
Lawrence.
This point. And Lawrence.
I think Lawrence would claim a little there too.
Lawrence Strong might, yes. Anyway, Perhaps. When they want to come on the podcast, they shall get their credit. Now, we will be putting your questions on all things new F1 cars to Dan Fallows in just a minute. Dan, a huge welcome to F1 Explains. It's lovely to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a delight to be on your podcast.
Our pleasure, our pleasure. And Dan, we're talking all about new cars in general. Not necessarily just the new Aston Martin for 2024 or new cars in the 2024 season. We're talking about thinking ahead to the new car. So when you're in one season, what's the earliest point you're thinking about the new car from the next season?
As you can imagine, probably a lot earlier than you might expect. It depends a little bit on what's happening with the regulations. Obviously, the years like 2022, we saw quite a big shift in the regulations. And again, we're going to see that in 2026. And in those situations, you have to start thinking about things maybe a bit earlier than you otherwise would do. But in reality, you know, we have to consider our build schedules and, you know, getting all of our designs onto the car as soon as we can. And, you know, so really it's shortly after the season starts that you really start to kick off those initial discussions. And then, you know, by the time we get to the shutdown in August time, it's all being designed in earnest. So, yeah, I mean, it feels like you get going with the season and you're already thinking about the next one. But, you know, in reality, it takes that long to design and build a car. So you have to start thinking about it that early.
How much design and engineering are actually going into this particular car versus that of a year before?
By the time we get to the start of a season, we've obviously done the major components of the car. There's, you know, the main chassis and things that you're unlikely to change during the season are already in place. But quickly, as with all these things, every time you see your car, you kind of look back a year or so and think, oh, goodness me, what was I doing? And particularly 2 years ago.
Is that you in particular or the team in particular?
Well, maybe it's just me, but I think everybody does. You know, we look back at the cars a couple of years ago under the same regulations and think, what on earth were we doing? And so by the time you get to the start of the season, maybe 2 or 3 races in, you're already kind of thinking, well, actually, I could do this an awful lot better. And, you know, if I had my time again, I'd do this. Well, fortunately, we do have our time again. So that's when we start kind of putting those things in place. But sometimes, you know, it's the conceptual things that you're starting to think about, you know, the big changes to the car. Whereas obviously, if they're small enough, you could realistically do it in season.
What's the first bit of 2025? Where does it start? I might be oversimplifying this question, but is the first thing of a new car typically, I don't know, the aero, the suspension, the floor? Like what's point one of like, right, let's look at next season?
Well, I think, as I said, if the regulations are stable as they are at the moment, certainly going into 2025, we're not expecting any major changes, then everything does come down to the aero, really. You know, we will know when the car hits the track whether our tools are telling us the right thing, whether there's anything that we need to work on, or whether there's anything that, you know, we might consider to be doing slightly differently with a completely new concept. And that's really where it starts from. So we would go into the wind tunnel with different concepts or look at things in CFD and the computers and see whether there's anything we could have done differently. The only trouble is that if you're not evolving your current car, then you normally have to take quite a big step back in performance in order to make that leap. So, you know, sometimes it's just a question of saying, well, we've gone in this direction, but what happens if you went in a totally different direction? What would that look like? And I think at this, you know, an early time of year, you can get away with that. Whereas towards the end of the development, you're certainly not going to spend the time on that.
One of the things I find really fascinating about new car development, and I actually have a background in classic cars, which is a unique one in general. But they talk a lot about designs of classic cars, and classic cars of the future oftentimes start as a sketch or drawn out on a piece of paper. There's Chip Foos, who's infamously known as the person who is written out on napkins, and the cars have come to fruition, right? How does that relate, or is there anything of that nature that, you know, you've sketched out here, or someone on your team has brought in a piece of paper and said, hey, middle of the night, darkness of the night, here's what I thought this would be a good ad. Have you guys ever seen it like that, you know, that little tiny detailed, or is it always big through computers now and everything of that nature?
No, we definitely see some of that. I mean, again, it's a little bit different when you get towards the end of a regulation set because things have started to converge a bit. But yeah, we all have those thoughts or conversations with ourselves in the middle of the night. And I regularly wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, suddenly realizing that I should have tried something else. And yeah, it is that. You need to have a notepad handy.
Is it ever like the start forward, or is it always that reflective thought, oh, dang, man, should have made a difference? Are you ever positive on that wake up at 3 a.m.?
Sadly, it's mostly reflexive, but yeah, you're right. So, but the really productive ones are when you wake up and think, oh gosh, that's the solution. I mean, I'm a big advocate of making sure people don't just sort of sit there staring at their computer screen for hours on end at the end of the day. You know, it's amazing how many times you sort of struggle away with a problem and then you go home and either late at night or in the middle of the night, you kind of suddenly think, oh yeah, gosh, that's the answer, and come in and smash it out within 5 minutes. So, and yeah, we encourage those kind of conversations with people as well. I think it's quite interesting to come in and sketch something out, and then you look at it on screen and talk to your colleagues about it and think, oh yeah, we could give that a go. And, you know, and a lot of the time it doesn't go anywhere, but at least it's new thinking, which is great.
Dan, I was at one particular team who I won't name, towards sort of 2/3 of the way through the 2023 season, and the lovely person who was giving me a look round said, all those people in that room are working on next year's car. They're exclusively focusing on next year's car. Now, and again, it might differ team to team, I guess, but would those people that I saw have purely at that point been focusing on the following season? Is there always a team of people looking at the following season? Or does that team of people sort of, you know, for example, at the start of the season, 90% are looking at this season? As we go forward, does that become 80%, 70% as it looks to the following year? How does that work?
Every team is different, and you know, there is a certain amount of strategy in how you approach that kind of thing. It's an interesting problem because obviously the more people you commit to your existing season's car, the more likely you are to have that success and bring those upgrades that you want. So you have to be sort of strategic about when you move people across. But you know, we have now in Formula One, the teams are sufficiently big that you can usually commit some level of resource to the following year's car. And also, again, it comes back to a little bit what you were saying before. It depends on what you're trying to do. If you believe that next year's car is going to be a bit of an evolution, then you know, it's probably to your benefit to keep the majority of people on the current year car. Whereas if you know things are going to be drastically different, either regulations or because you think conceptually you want to try something else, then it makes more sense to have a group of people working on that from, you know, quite early on.
That must be a fascinating balancing act, Dan, because you take a team like Aston Martin in 2023, who were constantly in the mix in the sort of top third in the grid. And obviously you're looking at that difference between second or third or fourth in the Constructors' Championship in 2023. But also we know from Aston Martin's ambitions, this is a team that wants to be winning races, winning world championships. So there must be that complex decision of how much we go into this year's regulations and this year's car and how much we're going to next year's. Whose decisions that, Dan? I mean, your technical director, is that your decision? Would it be a team principal? Would it be a collaborative approach? Who makes that decision? Again, appreciate that might be different team to team, and you can give us the Aston Martin perspective.
Yeah, I think we do try to do those kind of things collaboratively. I think it's quite important that we factor in all the different aspects of that, because you know, we saw last year that, you know, we started off the season very strongly and then we saw the rest of the competition or the teams that were near us come back very strongly towards the middle of the season, and we wanted to make sure that we understood where the car was going, what our upgrades were doing, because we felt that was the best chance of informing our development for this year's car. So, that was a collective decision, to something that we spoke about a lot. And we saw last season that we were bringing upgrades quite late into the season, really trying to sort of get to grips with the things that we'd done to the car. And, I believe that's definitely paid off, but it's not the same approach as you would take every season. But that's the kind of thing that has to come from, the input from the drivers, from the race team, and obviously from the technical side as well. We have to believe that that's going to, deliver something for us if we take that approach. So yeah, but it's very much a collective decision. Yeah.
And it seems like there is a little bit of it that is performance based as well, right? So like you could be starting the next season's car or thought process or whatever, and then you see how the performance of 2023's car, and you're like, oh wait, maybe we should halt on that. Let's work and rework our ideas. Is that ever a performance base where it's kind of, you got to rework before you go forward again?
Yeah, there definitely is. And the other thing is that you've got an opportunity with a car that's running on track. You've got an opportunity to try things on it. And obviously with very restricted testing, we don't have the opportunity to build a whole new car and say, okay, we're going to start something new and then spend 2 months testing it before the season starts. So your current car, so in this example, let's say the 23 car, we were able to say, well, there are things we can realistically bring to that, and that will inform our decisions for the AMR 24 this year. And that was a really useful thing to do for us. I mean, it was a sort of extended test session. It seems a bit seems a bit crazy to use a race weekend, especially sprint race weekends, as a test session, but that's what we did.
You know, you got to do what you got to do. Sometimes you just got to do what you got to do.
Yeah.
John from Columbus, Ohio, here in the States, said, how much does a team's car change from one season to the next, which you're kind of touching on a little bit? And how often do teams completely redesign their car versus evolving from the previous year's concept? So again, a little bit of touching on what we are, but I think really fine tuning that answer to really understand the true differences.
Well, I mean, our car this year, as an example, the AMR 24 is an evolution of last year's car. And we believe it's a strong evolution of that. So it's changes in lots of areas. But it is an evolution. But having said that, the majority of the cars still changed. So even though, effectively it's you run from one season straight into the next one with the same conceptual car, the majority of those parts have changed. The chassis has changed, both the front and rear suspension has changed. I mean, we have our suspension and gearbox is actually bought in from Mercedes in terms of the structure. But that's changed for this year. So even that's all staying the same. So yeah, the vast majority of the car is different, and that seems a bit crazy, doesn't it? If you've got a car which works and it has puts four wheels on the ground and goes around corners, then why would you need to change it that much? But there are opportunities for gains absolutely everywhere around the car, and you see those year on year. So we want to exploit those. We want to make sure we're making the best out of these new ideas and get them on the track as soon as we can.
Dan, another one of our listeners' questions, this being from Ian in Virginia. Now, Ian says, sometimes teams will put something totally new on their cars. For example, a new type of aerodynamic bodywork that's never been seen before. When a totally new part or new invention is introduced to a car, does it have to go through an approval process from the FIA? So I guess, Dan, an example of that could have been, we were seeing teams at one stage having a sort of zero side pods approach, really very thin side pods. So take when a team comes up with something like that, like this is brand new, does it have to be run past the FIA first, go, is this all right, Gov?
That's a very interesting question, actually, because everybody knows that we have regulations that we adhere to. So, the obvious conclusion to that would be, well, no, you don't. You just read the regulations and come up with the parts. But it's absolutely true that the regulations are written in a certain way, anticipating that you're going to design in your car in a certain way. And we're in a fortunate position in this sport that we do have a collaborative approach with the FIA. It's not like football referees, but it's very much them and us. We have all these advisory committees, and we help the FIA define the regulations. We try and spot holes in them and make sure that they're consistent for everybody. But having said that, you always, you'll find that teams will find ways to spot small loopholes or interpretations which are beneficial for what they want to do. So if you get into that situation and you know that it's a little bit controversial, or it could be read one of two ways. You can either choose to, you know, put those parts on the car and hope that the FIA agree with you, which is a fairly risky approach, and I'm not sure many people take that. Or you can try and engage with them and say, you know, look, this is the way we read these regulations. This is what we want to do with it. Are you happy with that? And, you know, and it becomes a very interesting conversation, because sometimes they'll say, oh, gosh, what are you thinking? And sometimes they'll say, oh, yeah, okay, very clever. We agree with that. So, yeah, it is an interesting process. It doesn't happen a huge amount, I suppose, but we have seen that, you know, for example, the zero sideboards that Mercedes did, that needed some interpretation. And I think when that came out, we all kind of looked at the pictures and thought, oh, that's interesting. How did they manage to do that? And it took a moment to see how they'd worked the regulations around that way. But, you know, we're all, in truth, trying to look for those areas where we can get that advantage by finding these kind of ambiguities, and then making sure the FIA are happy with them, and then, you know, sticking something on the car.
I suppose a great example of that, one of the best in Formula One's history, is in the 2009 season when Braun GP came in and went the diffuser, which was a part of the back of the car. If we had a double diffuser, two of those, that will help us get more aerodynamic grip, especially at the back of the car, to which Red Bull, their great rivals at the time, went, is that allowed? And there was a great big load of discussion as to whether it was allowed. You know, effectively, that was the decision that won the world championship. With things like that, more in general, will there be mandatory tests that cars have to pass before they race?
So, yeah, I'm glad you moved on from the Braun thing, because I was at Red Bull at the time, so it's quite a sore point for me. Rather not go into that if we can avoid it.
We don't want to open up old wounds
well
on this
done,
podcast.
Christian. Look what we're doing. Look, he might get up and move away from this one.
Dan,
bye, Dan.
Dan, you were the one that said, oh, we probably wouldn't run through the FIA. We'd just go and do it. They took your advice.
Yes, 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 yes. As I said, let's move on from that one. We do have mandatory tests that we need to pass. I mean, there's obviously the sort of crash testing things that go, that the cars have to go through, which is absolutely fundamental to the safety of the cars. But we now, with the regulations as we are now, we have the FIA are essentially look at our files, our release surfaces of our car, and they go through the way that we've constructed the car, and, you know, they with reference to the regulations, and they look at each aspect of that, and they, you know, contend themselves that the way that we've constructed the car is in line with the regulations. And then that one, it means that when we get to the circuit, they can scan the car using a scanning system. And provided the car is, you know, consistent with those surfaces that we've shown them, they can then say that it's legal. So, yeah, there's a series of checks we have to go through. You know, again, if there's any questions about that or we update the car, then they can go through that process again. So it's something we weren't too sure about how that was going to work when it first came in, but actually it's become quite a slick process now.
One of the things I find really special about Formula One is unveiling cars. And there's plenty of little things that you can see on a car that are changes, but there's a ton underneath, obviously, what meets the eye that are big changes. What are some of those that maybe can help navigate, when help others when they see those, that, hey, there's other things going on as well?
So, yeah, we try and keep all of this stuff as secret as humanly possible. I mean,
sorry.
I know that, yeah, because I'm not going to say anything, no.
Don't worry, we won't tell anyone.
Secret is safe.
it's inevitable. We want to release the car. I mean, I always think the two saddest words in Formula One are livery launch. It's nice for fans to be able to see the new car in all its glory, and, you know, we like to make sure that we do that as well. But equally, whilst it's nice for people to see the car, I also want to see them to see as little of it as possible, because it means our competitors can then see all of those details. But I think, you know, once you see changes on the visible bits of the bodywork and the suspension, and particularly changes around the floor with these regulations at the moment, you get a hint of what's going on underneath. There's normally an enormous amount of work that goes into making these sort of very large aerodynamic surfaces and getting them to work properly. And a lot of the devices around the car are really sort of tuning devices to try and get these big things to work properly. You know, we have ground effect cars now. They operate very close to the ground. They're big, wide floors. They produce a huge amount of downforce, but it's very critical to the working of those things, how the air moves around it. So, you know, you sometimes, I think, when people have done what you see as subtle changes to the side pod, it's tempting to think that that's a means to it, to an end, but actually it's very much about how the flow works around the rest of the floor and the rest of the car.
Because of what you just said there, Dan, I'm aware that a lot of the time in modern Formula One, the first time we're seeing the actual challenger of that season is at pre-season testing. And other teams are obviously doing what you've just said and trying to keep it a secret for as long as possible. Therefore, particularly at pre-season testing or the first Grand Prix of the season, how much do we see you guys studying the other cars as you get the chance? And I've also seen that during the season. One of the best examples is Sebastian Vettel, ex-Aston Martin driver, who used to take great pleasure when he was on the podium of going and standing as and having a good old look at the Mercedes or the Red Bull or something like that, quite shamelessly, because he's Sebastian Vettel, could do what he likes at that point. But how much do you have to have a try and have a sneaky look at the other cars early doors?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be absolutely lying if I said we don't take any interest at all, because, you know, there's nine other teams in there with lots of smart people who are, you know, trying to solve the same problems that we have. And you'd be foolish not to try and have a look at what other people have done. Ultimately, if you look at the car as a series of problems, then you're really looking at the culmination of a series of solutions to those problems. So, you know, it's very interesting to see how people have adopted that approach. And sometimes you can look at other people's cars and think, okay, well, that's interesting. I'm not sure, you know, I would necessarily have done that, but that's interesting. And sometimes you look at it and think, oh gosh, that's a great idea. So I think it's natural. You know, we all look around for inspiration. And also, you know, it is a competition. We're here to compete, and aerodynamicists and the people who design the concept of the car are just as competitive as anybody else is. So if you get the impression by looking at someone's car that, you know, you think they've done a better job even before it's turned a wheel, then, you know, you'll be straight back to your CAD box and trying to design something different.
I want to pick up on the secrecy that you mentioned earlier, Dan. And of course, that is what a lot of Formula One is, right? A little secret here, a little secret there. How do we keep it concealed until the time is to really show what you have? And one question that's kind of stood out to me is when a driver bebops from team to team, you mentioned Sebastian Vettel, Christian, how does that one driver, how do you guys keep it so that that driver doesn't reveal some of those secrets that they're then bringing into the team? Is that something that, is that, or is that another secret?
No, not at all. I mean, we've been very fortunate in recent years that, you know, Sebastian Vettel was obviously with us and did leave, but he retired. So we weren't in that situation. That's something fortunate. But, you know, I think every team has that, you know, it's not just drivers, but when staff leave, you have a choice about whether you want to kind of isolate them from these things. With drivers, they do see a lot. They see a lot of data. They're obviously part of a lot of conversations. I think, you know, thinking about when this has happened in the past, I think your drivers become so much part of the team, as do your teammates. And, you know, there comes a point where it's inevitable that they're going to leave, and they're going to take some information with them. It's in their heads. You know, they're aware of what you've been doing. But, you know, you can't just mistrust people or take them out of the process. I've always taken the approach you just need to keep people included for as long as possible, accept that they're going to take something with them when they go somewhere else. But by the time they get there, you will have moved on, you know, and I think that's the best approach, really.
And you mentioned earlier, Dan, that very early on in one particular season, you're looking at the following season's car. You also mentioned earlier rule changes, and every, you know, 5 or 6 years or so, for argument's sake, Formula One will have a bit of a change in the rules, as most motorsport categories do. And the next one of those that we're building up to in Formula One is 2026. We'll be looking at this a lot more on F1 Explains throughout this season. And it's a big one for you guys at Aston Martin, because that's when you'll be welcoming a new engine supplier with Honda. So not just the car changing for you guys with new rules, but also the engine supplier changing as well. How much are you already, as we sit here in 2024, thinking about 2026?
Well, we have a situation with the 26 rules where all the teams have agreed that we won't do any aerodynamic work on those until the beginning of next year. So that means you could argue we're sitting there for the best part of 12 months twiddling our thumbs. But of course we're not. And as you said, exactly, we are in a different situation to most, that we have to go from buying in our gearboxes, rear suspension, and having a Mercedes power unit, to a situation which we're very excited about, the new Honda power unit, and also being able to design our own gearbox and rear suspension. And all of those things take a long time. I mean, integrating with a new power unit partner is a big deal. It's a very big cultural shift. You have to find ways of working with them that are different than the way you did before. And also, you know, designing a gearbox from scratch and rear suspension is a big deal as well. So we're having to start that much, much earlier than we otherwise would do. So we have teams of people working on that already. You know, that's a big focus for us. But really, the sort of architecture of the car, if you like, the way it's sort of going to start to look and perform is really going to be defined from the beginning of next year. So, I mean, we can't wait to get started, though. I mean, it's a very exciting time when you have new regulations.
Yeah, no, I can understand how that could really shift and chivvy some things around a little bit and make it very exciting for teams and also for fans and those who are involved in the community as well. Dan, as we kind of talked about those 3 a.m. wake-ups and you kind of reflectively look back about those things, but how about looking forward to the 2024 car? What are some of the concepts or things, you know, parts of it, concepts of it, maybe team-wise, that you're really particularly proud of going into the 2024 season?
Well, we've been on quite a journey over the last, you know, 2 or 3 years here at Aston Martin, and I think it's 2023 was a big season for us, you know, having come out with a good car. But we've also we moved into our new technical center here. We've got this incredible new facility, and we're building a new wind tunnel and new simulator facilities and so on. So there's a huge amount of change, but to be able to do what we did last year and to move factory at the same time was quite a tall order. But the sort of cohesion in the team and the sort of motivation is just building all the time. And I think that's probably the most exciting thing. So as we move into the 24 season, you know, we've got a car which we believe is a really good platform for development. You know, that's something we really wanted to focus on, making sure it was a great starting point for us to be able to add that performance on during the season and really, really compete at that, you know, in the kind of mid-season development race in the way that we'd like to. And just to see that, you know, the motivation with everybody to achieve those goals and to build on this car that we have now, I think that's just a, you know, phenomenal thing. And, you know, it's something we talk about. 2026 obviously is a big thing for us, but, you know, we just want to see that consistent growth and performance through the team. And, you know, that's just what this year is going to be all about for us.
Dan, the one thing I do know about the role of a technical director is it's a busy one. So really do appreciate you taking the time to speak to us. Your insight has been absolutely fascinating. I know the thousands of people that listen to this podcast all over the world will be as grateful as well. So really do appreciate your time, Dan. Thanks so much for joining us on F1 Explained.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. No, I enjoy listening to your podcast. So it's, thank you very much for inviting me on.
Oh, our pleasure, Dan, and we'll take that. Thank you very much. We'll put that on the, as recommended by Dan Fallows, Aston Martin Technical Director.
Absolutely. It's a firm recommendation.
That was such a treat to have Dan on F1 Explains. Christian, what was your biggest takeaway?
My biggest takeaway was of last season, the whole season, which was my first working in Formula One full time, that it just never stops. Everybody in Formula One is always looking ahead. So here we are in the 2024 season, but I just love the fact there's almost never a point where they're not thinking about the 2025 season. And as we talked with Dan about the regulations, yes, exactly, the 2026 season. It's just this sort of non-stop cycle of driving yourself to be the best season after season after season. And you're constantly thinking about mistakes you can correct and what you can learn. I just think it's fantastic.
So at the beginning of season in February, and then the launch of cars and what they look like. And are you one of those guys who like has the lineup from like last year to this year and are picking and choosing and seeing the differences between the two, just out of curiosity?
I am, yes. I like the before and after from, for example, 23 to 24. I also like the difference between the teams. And the best example of that as we went into last season was we saw Mercedes have their very thin side pods. And like Red Bull and Ferrari had much thicker, bulkier side pods. And it's like, well, who's right? And it transpired last season that the zero side pod approach didn't really work. So you get those early clues as to teams going different directions. And then you watch it unfold across the season as to who's gone in the right way. It's a real exciting part of preseason for me. I love that.
Yeah, no, it's very exciting. And hey, it's what's so wonderful about F1 is we're kicking off this 2024 season and there's a whole lot more excitement to come. You've heard questions answered from Fan and David and John and Ian and Mills this week. You could have your question answered by an expert. Again, that's F1 Explains at F1.com. That's our brand spanking new email address. And speaking of F1.com, that's the place for all the latest and greatest ahead of the 2024 season.
Now, don't forget F1 TV is also available too. You might live in a part of the world where you can watch the races live, but in plenty of other parts of the world, there is race action, highlights, and exclusive shows from Tech Talk to Jolyon Palmer's analysis, plus a whole archive of races from the past for you to get lost in and dig into, which is, honestly, Katie, that is such a brilliant part of that website. Like, all of Formula One is just there. It's my favorite thing about F1 TV. I love it.
Oh, I go to sleep with it too. I think F1 TV is such a great resource. It's so worth the amount of money. And that's not because either of us work alongside F1 TV. It's such a great resource to consume F1 content. There are two other official F1 podcasts for you to enjoy this season, F1 Beyond the Grid and F1 Nation. And of course, F1 Explains is here with new episodes every Friday all season long. So please don't forget to subscribe and enjoy your Fridays with Christian and I and producer Chris.
And not just Fridays either. Next week, something very exciting for you. Two brand new episodes released Friday and Saturday as a special treat to kick off the new season, because we're very good to you, listeners. We're really good to you. You're very welcome. We'll be explaining how one of the most successful TV programs of the last decade is made. It is the sport documentary that changed everything. Drive to Survive.
I think that's actually very true. It has changed everything about the sport of Formula One, and I think motorsport in general, and TV and docuseries.
Yeah, and sports documentaries. He's been revolutionary in sports documentaries as a whole.
Yeah, and we're going to go behind the scenes at Formula One's preseason tests in Bahrain to find out why it is so important to test and tell you exactly what the teams and drivers get up to as the wheels turn for the first time all season long.
That is true. Katie, lovely to be back with you. I've had a lovely time.
I'm so glad to be back with you and producer Chris in the shadows, behind the black curtain.
And producer Chris always insists we get a mention, or he gets very cross. Don't forget, you can email us f1explains@f1.com. We'll put your questions to our experts. But that is it from this week. For me, Christian Hugill, and Katie Osborne on F1 Explains. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.